The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder if God can really do anything. If he is really all-knowing, if he is really all-powerful, why does he allow so many lousy movies to be produced? If God knew before the beginning of time, even before he laid the foundation of the world, that Con Air would come out in theaters, that people would actually go to see it. If God knew ahead of time about movie remakes of TV shows that were once good, only to be absolutely massacred when they were remade on the screen. Movies like Lost in Space, movies like Leave It to Beaver. Well, you just wonder why a loving God would even allow this. And who better to explore the phenomenon of good film versus bad film than film critic Mark Boobian. Mark, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Bob. I claim free will here, and then I'm going to move on.
Okay.
The mysteries of the universe can always be explained by free will. That's the way I look at it anyway. So thanks, Bob, for having me on. We're not going to talk about bad movies today. Thank goodness. Thank God.
Well, I saw a couple that were, well, at least they weren't great. I don't know that I'd call them bad.
Uh-oh. So now we are going to talk about bad movies.
A little bit,
saying.
Because I saw Tomorrowland, okay. And I saw San Andreas. San Andreas was predictable. Hold on to your seats, everybody. A couple that's going through a divorce. And the catastrophe throws them together and makes them closer. We've never seen one like that in the movies before. I was on the edge of my seat.
Right. Well, you know, it's an earthquake movie. They've got to come up with something unique to put into it because there's...
But it was fun. Usually if it's that predictable, I don't enjoy it. This time right. I did. The special effects were good. Started The Rock, although they call him by his real name now, and I can't even remember his real name.
Dwayne Johnson.
I think of him as The Rock. I don't think of him as Dwayne Johnson. Right. Tomorrowland was the other one I saw.
Right.
Now, Dana and I were at Disneyland, and in the real Tomorrowland at Disneyland, they'll now show previews for Disney movies. They did this with Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Oh. And they preview a movie the way I always would have preferred to see movies previewed. I don't think you would still like it, Mark. They'll show you like the first 10 minutes of the movie.
Well, that and I wouldn't mind.
I'd like that better because you're starting to see the story. I mean, it's virtually. Yeah. They showed a few other cuts, but... Virtually, you're seeing this one real long scene. It's from the very beginning of the movie. It starts out when Tomorrowland was part of the World's Fair in the early 60s. I guess they had a Tomorrowland exhibit, and that was when they actually premiered Small World.
Even though
it found a home in Fantasyland when it got to Disneyland, it was in Tomorrowland.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're watching it, you're going, this really looks good. Then I read the reviews, and they said it's a George Clooney agenda movie about global warming. When I finally saw it, it wasn't as bad as the reviews made it out to be, but it certainly wasn't as good as the Disney preview made it out to be. So very mixed review. Started out great. Continued to be pretty good. I certainly enjoyed the first half more than the second half. But anyway, I'd be curious, Mark, to see your opinion of it. But it's somewhere in between. You walk out of there disappointed that you didn't love it, but relieved that you didn't hate it.
Right, right. Well, I didn't see it because I was busy watching guys driving cars like crazy through the desert and dinosaurs eating lots and lots and lots of people.
That's a remake of Mad Max?
It's not a remake. Now, see, the interesting thing is this
year
we've
got this... Is this a movie called Mad Max? Oh, but it's another in the series, but it's
right.
not a remake.
Right, it's not a remake.
I like that better. I hate remakes.
Yeah.
I just hate them.
I call it, though, a pseudo-reboot. You know, like with Spider-Man, they just kicked the whole cast out and then started over, did the first movie all over again with new people. which well, they're going to do again
different
a third
because
time.
In that case, the original is the comic book and not the movie.
No,
anyway.
I mean that in the they Sam Raimi directed the first three Spider-Man movies, quit or was fired, depending on who
but
you talk to.
But didn't they reboot it by starting the story all over again?
Yes, okay, that's well, then how that, they rebooted
well, then that that's is how, that's like a remake then.
Yes, because they're exactly. Doing, okay, so now yes, these yes. movies, Jurassic World and Mad Max, are not like that. They're actually the fourth or third okay. or second part in the series.
Well, the sequels to Jurassic Park were terrible.
I generally, liked,
the
yeah.
first one was okay, although not nearly as good as the book.
Okay, so you're breaking the rules here, man. We're supposed to talk about good movies. You keep bringing up the bad ones. I got the good ones on tap here. Mad Max, man. There's nothing bad about Mad Max. He's all good.
Even the remake of Mad or the sequel.
Reboot.
Mad. Reboot.
Pseudo-reboot. Sort of thing, okay. yeah. So the beauty of Mad Max is that George Miller, who directed the very first, second, and third and only Mad Max movies, is the guy in charge of the one now. The only problem I really had with the movie is Mel Gibson could have been in it, and he wasn't, because they're trying to introduce it to a new audience and continue.
Was it because he's blemished his name in Hollywood so
I don't
much?
I don't think so. No, he was never really planned to be in the new version in Mad Max 4, I guess we would call it. The
But it is a story that takes place later in the Mad
yeah,
Max.
Yeah,
I've never seen. I never even saw the Mel Brooks Mad Max movies. I have never seen a Mad Max
right.
movie.
Yeah, the Mel Brooks would have done
not
a very
Mel
different
Brooks,
version.
Mel Gibson.
Yeah, Mad Max is really. I love the series. People have mixed feelings about it. It's Australian, so it's a little tweaked and weird and funky and weird and weird. I don't know if I mentioned
that part.
I think what
Mark's saying
yet.
Is that it was weird. Everybody.
Yeah, but I love it. You just kind of got to move past the weirdness and then. Embrace it.
If you like sci-fi action fare, if you like your science fiction, you like your action, you like the two together, you'll love at least the original Mad Max.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a good movie. The original Mad Max, though, is really heart-wrenching, and none of the others are, because his family is killed in the movie, which is why he becomes Mad Max. He's not Mad Crazy Max. He's Mad Angry Max. So that's just a little... tidbit, a little piece of trivia for you there.
If you like Mel Brooks, don't see it because he really has nothing to do with it.
Right.
It would be a very different movie.
Yes. He might do one like it. You could. You never know.
Where's my Tina Turner cameo in this new Mad Max movie?
Yeah, I wish. They should have had a song by her. I actually
really
expected
should.
That. That would have been great.
The best? If they're, yeah. they're you know, going down the road.
See, now they could have had you do it because you that was perfect Tina Turner right there.
Thanks.
You have a second job.
It's a Tina Turner impersonator.
Right.
I don't know about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Vegas, they'll accept anybody. They don't ask questions. But so I love Mad Max, but it's one of those movies that's really funky and weird, and you kind of have to have a taste for it. But it did well enough that I think they're going to make some more. So I'm very happy about that. And because George Miller is in charge, that makes it really a real Mad Max movie. The other interesting thing about it is the villain in the new Mad Max movie was the same actor who played the villain in the original. So I didn't recognize him at all because he's got a big thing on his face the whole time. But I thought that was really neat. So kind of, you know, takes it back to the original, connects the series. So go see it if you can bear a rated R movie. That's rated R. Jurassic World, on the other hand, you can take your kids to. As long as they can handle, you know, people being chewed up by dinosaurs left and right.
Or they give it only a PG because PG-13. People are being eaten by dinosaurs.
Yeah, PG-13. They're only being eaten by dinosaurs, not run over by cars.
Now, did Spielberg have any association with this one?
Absolutely he did.
He didn't direct it.
No, he had another director come in, but he was in charge of really, really, really hands-on with it. When they were first going into production, it was June of, I think, 2 years ago. The production was supposed to start. The script was written in 3 weeks. Spielberg got his hands on the script and said, "You're not starting production. You're going to wait because this isn't a good enough movie." And you know, Spielberg speaks and the studio listens. And good they did because this movie was actually a pretty good movie. It's, you know, predictable Jurassic Park movie. But it harkens back to the original enough that you won't feel like, oh, boy, it's just like one of those sequels. You know, they're just
slapping it together. See a T-Rex on a boat arriving in Seaport Village and eating up San Diego this time.
No, they did that already. This is totally original. It's a T-Rex on an island eating people or something like a T-Rex on an island eating people. That's what you get. But that's what you're expecting to get. Now, the director who did this was his name is, boy, I I don't know how to say his last name, but it's Colin Trevorrow, I think. And pardon me if I just butchered it, but he did a movie called Safety Not Guaranteed, which is one of my favorite independent movies, just a random discovery on Netflix. And it's a beautiful, fun, touching, childlike movie that just is great. And has just a great ending too. It's so satisfying. It's a movie that just there's no letdown. Even though it's a little bit melancholy at times, it still works great. And one of the things that I really felt I connected with in that movie was that it's very childlike in certain ways. The main character, the main male character, he's trying to build a time machine to go back in time to do something, but he's so childlike and so innocent, and he's so relatable. And the actor and the director really did an amazing job at creating that character. And all the other characters in the movie are also beautifully done. So this is the person they decided to have come in and take over, because I think they felt he could do a Spielberg movie. Because Spielberg, that's one of his trademarks. He likes kind of childlike aspects to his film. And that's absolutely to Spielberg's credit, though maybe a little too much, because they're, you know, we can look at all of his movies. It almost became like a template for 80s
movies. He's a mixed bag for me. I have not liked everything Spielberg does. When he's good, he's great.
Right, and neither have I. And even in the movies that are good, there are things I don't like, and sometimes they do have to do with the childlike things or the childish things that he produces. Like in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the dreamer, the husband, Richard Dreyfuss, he's the dreamer. But his family just, boy, do they stink or
and
what?
They didn't do a great job with character development in that movie. It was a brilliant story.
Right.
The cinematography was fantastic.
I thought they did a good job of building the wonder of Richard Dreyfuss did a good job of
childlike eyes. Well, you know the scene at the beginning where he wants to take everyone to Pinocchio?
Oh, yeah. You said that that's been cut from the theatrical,
that
right?
That was not in the theatrical. It was when he made the special edition and the director's cut, he put that back in. And I thought that made a big positive difference.
Right, it would. It would. And I have never seen that scene. I've only seen Close Encounters, I think, on VHS. So I'm, which
it,
is, means
it makes
I have
a
to
big difference because it does. It establishes him as being childlike right at the beginning of the movie, which we didn't get before.
Right, and that's But they still. I think
plus
he still
explains
pulled it off
why they're
the
playing
end.
When You Wish Upon a Star at the end of the movie, either, which makes no sense without that scene.
Right, but I consider that to be a good movie, and that
was a good movie.
And that the innocence of the character really is one of the connecting aspects of it. It's his family. To me, Spielberg kind of threw the family out to make the main character more childlike.
And he has expressed regret. He has said that, you know, as the years went by and he became a family man, he regrets that he glorified somebody just leaving his family behind to take a journey throughout his
space. He should regret that he glorified a family being so sucky. They were awful.
Yeah, that particular family, you could kind of not blame the guy. Yeah.
Right. Terry Garr was hot, but he needed to run for the hills. That didn't matter. Boy.
On the other hand, you can kind of see her point of view when she wakes up in the morning and he's throwing trees inside their window. And
right.
Okay. Saying, Ronnie, if I don't do this, I'll go insane.
So, yeah, right. There you
all
go.
All right. We're here with film critic Mark Boubian on The Bob Siegel Show. We'll be right back.
Now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
Some more beautiful.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with film critic Mark Boubian.
Thanks, Bob. So talking more about Spielberg and some of his tropes, being childlike, I think, is one of his biggest, most obvious ones. Let's stick with that because that's one of the reasons I think they picked the director Colin Trevorrow for Jurassic World, because he did a great job of working that childlike wonder of dinosaurs into it much better than the original movie, I thought, the first Jurassic Park. In the first Jurassic Park, they spent a lot of time wandering around dinosaurs, showing you dinosaurs, wow, dinosaurs, aren't they neat, and boring. I'm sorry. I loved dinosaurs as a kid, but boy,
that's true. I loved dinosaurs as a kid too. I can't stand reptiles as an adult. They freak me out.
Yeah, that's weird, huh?
But every little kid I've ever known, including myself, including my son at that age, were just always fascinated by dinosaurs. I remember when I was in grade school, when we finally got off the subject of dinosaurs, and they started talking about the missions and rancheros of California.
Funny. Yeah.
Can you imagine being a little kid and we're going to stop talking about dinosaurs and talk about the missions? Oh, what a sleeper.
Right. Boring. Okay, yeah. I mean, I'm all into the missions now, but that would have been boring as a kid, right? And I had a Catholic education. We didn't talk about the missions. I don't know how they...
We need a movie where some dinosaurs eat up some people inside missions.
There you go. That would be the perfect, you know, connection between the two. And then they could show it in schools. That would be awesome.
And it would fit the theme of our show, Christianity and its relationship to pop culture.
There you go. Right. It's the perfect storm of movie. All right. So, Something I liked about Jurassic World was that, again, that he did capture that, what we're talking about, something that's, I don't know if it's just boys or what, but yeah, that wonder of dinosaurs, but also sort of the overriding aspect of being like a child. You know, we, as a kid, you have hope and joy. There's a wonder at everything, practically amazement and us also, of course, innocence and unconditional love. A Spielberg movie where innocence plays a big role would be The Terminal, where the main characters, that's his key, that's his charisma, that he's so innocent. And that's, the whole movie rides on that practically. And Tom Hanks did a wonderful job pulling that off. So again, that childlike aspect really can work well when it's done right. And in the original Jurassic Park, you had two kind of bratty little kids that I couldn't stand the two kids in Jurassic Park. And boy, that really wrecks the movie when your two kid characters who are supposed to be the most relatable just don't work. In this movie, it's like they abandon all cliche, almost all cliche. It's two boys instead of a boy and a girl. They're brothers. Now, their parents are getting a divorce. That's another Spielberg thing, but it's very hinted at. It's not developed. And then
they not get a divorce by the time the movie's over?
It's not stated at the end. I actually
Do they get along better by the time the movie's over?
No, there's not enough time for that. They don't show you. Oh, okay. There's no resolution of that aspect of their relationship whatsoever. The parents do
Hollywood needs a movie about a dysfunctional family that stays together, but just has all these other kinds of problems.
Right. Well, yeah.
Instead of the cliche of the divorce.
Right. That would be a comedy like Vacation, probably.
that's true.
That's how they usually do those kind of movies. But the boys, there's a younger boy who really has that. He's that age that I was when I loved dinosaurs. And he's charging through the place. Come on, let's go see the dinosaurs. And it takes him forever to get to the dinosaurs. And I'm like, come on, let's get to the dinosaurs. I was totally on his, I was with that kid. I mean, it was great. And that really was very good filmmaking. Much better method of showing you that wonder and showing you and building you up to dinosaurs are going to be so cool. Instead of like pounding you with how cool dinosaurs are by showing them to you, he went the other way and kind of hid them, and you didn't see them right away, but you got to see the characters reacting.
In fact, I actually thought the scariest, most gripping scene of the first Jurassic Park movie was the scene where a dinosaur was inside a cage and you did not see it.
Right.
They were feeding it. That Spielberg's very good at that. But what I didn't like about the first movie, and it sounds like they have it in this one, is I was always disappointed that we didn't see the park open and get a look at what it would be like if the public's actually attending the park. This was just a few people examining the park ahead of time in the first movie.
Yeah, he was about to open, and then
so I always wanted to see the park really open. Well, so if they have that in this movie, I think I would enjoy that more.
I'm not sure, because I kind of had mixed feelings about it. This may be a spoiler, but whatever. The thing is that...
You mean someone gets killed by a dinosaur? That's probably not a spoiler.
Right, okay. Yeah, I guess not. But they really don't develop... Like, there's just the same couple of people that you're, chasing around the whole place.
So the public is there, but you're only following a few.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're... You kind of are left wondering, like, what's going to happen to those people? And the main characters don't... There's sort of this, we got to save the people. Herd them out of here. Herd them into there. Move them this way. Move them that way. But that's all that ever happens.
You're not really seeing these people that much?
You're seeing them,
but you don't get to know who any of them are.
Exactly. Okay. There's nothing about them that really, they're just a crowd of people move from left to right, and that's it. And so the threat against the people is there, but it just is never really, capitalized on as well as it could have been. So I don't think that was an aspect of the movie that really was, it didn't harm the movie really, but it wasn't as great as, like you're saying, Bob, it seemed like it would have been neat if that they did that in the original.
Yeah, and to see a lot of it and see what the amusement park's like before everything suddenly goes awry.
Yeah, now they did that a little bit. They had a good SeaWorld scene with a big shark fed to a huge dinosaur. Now,
oh my gosh.
Bring
in Shamu. Now, it's a little different than SeaWorld. Shamu's the bait this time.
Right. Actually, it was Jaws was the bait. I was so happy to see a shark eaten. Probably is why
that
liked
was probably
movie.
Spielberg making fun of himself.
Yeah,
Jaws was one of his first blockbuster movies.
Right, there you go. But that scene to me, so this huge thing comes out, eats the shark. Okay, the shark's like the size of its nose or something. It's this dinosaur is massive, and they're like, it's a whole SeaWorld thing where the ladies.
Well,
got
as them. A surfer, that must have been justice for you to see shark eaten.
But it scared the heck out of me. Like, the whole crowd's there. Yay. Nobody runs away, which would be the normal response to a huge monster jumping out of the water. So it kind of was, that was a little detrimental, I thought. But.
Well, at least PETA won't write letters on behalf of the dinosaurs since they don't really exist.
Right.
You know, this would be another whole show, but they are finding some fossils with living tissue on some dinosaurs.
Very interesting.
Raises great questions about whether dinosaur men ever really lived side by side. But that's a show for another time. We'll be right back.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
What better review of a book than to check with the customers themselves? Here is a recent customer review of Bob Siegel's fantasy novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. Superior. As a middle school teacher, I am a prolific reader of juvenile fiction and an even tougher critic of the genre. With that said, I experienced sheer delight in reading the page-turner, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament by Bob Siegel. Mike, the sixth grade protagonist in the story, is a well-drawn character with all the weaknesses and strengths of a 12-year-old. Mike's e-ticket adventure engages the reader with his shenanigans of making his veggies disappear, cat talk, and creating a twin who doubles for him. Not only that, Bob Siegel skillfully weaves a subtle moral message with the metaphoric thread, which encourages a kid to be the best version of himself, all the while addressing the various angst of preteens. Finally, I was captivated to the last page, but disappointed when the Christmas ride of the magical ornament came to a satisfying conclusion. I can't wait for the sequel. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
First it was just Jurassic Park, now it's Jurassic World. And here to discuss it with us is film critic Mark Boubian.
Thanks, Bob. Yes, it's a whole world of Jurassic Island. I don't know.
Oh, it's an island slash amusement park?
Yes, just like the original. And they built it on the same island. I don't know why they would have opened it after everybody was killed in the first.
I assume they never explained that, because there was a decision in the first movie not to ever open it because it wasn't safe.
No, they didn't explain it. They just, okay, we're open. And there's a rich guy.
I know the explanation. The first movie made money. Right. That would explain it.
Yes. Well, and speaking of money, this movie is the second biggest opening weekend of all time.
Of all time?
Yes.
What is the first biggest
of Avengers, all time? The first Avengers. Wow. Actually, the funny thing is Avengers Age of Ultron was the second biggest opening of all time a couple of weeks ago. Now it's the third biggest opening
of all
time.
Those darn dinosaurs are quick into any party.
Yeah. And then there's Furious 7, sorry. That was, I think, the fifth biggest opening of all time yet a couple of other weeks ago. So we've had three massive movies this year already, and it's not even the 4th of July yet. So big hopes for the Terminator. Pressure's on for the Terminator. But, I mean, last year was a real dud when it came to movies. It was just a bummer of a year. So this year really is stacking up, and the money is rolling in for Hollywood. Already Avengers and Furious 7, both of those are over $1 billion worldwide. So that's lots and lots of money. But, you know, money doesn't make a movie good. So I still like Jurassic World, even if money doesn't make a movie good. This was a good movie. I really enjoyed it. And like I was saying, the characters, unlike the original, the two younger people, one's a teenager, one's a kid, they really are relatable. They act natural. They don't do stupid things like, this is a Unix system, I can do this. There's nothing like that, you know, nothing that's embarrassing for the kids. So
there's no Wesley Crusher saving the ship.
No. And the kids didn't save Jurassic World in the end. And I was thinking,
I don't recall them saving it in the first one.
Yeah,
either,
this is a Unix system, I can do this. She saved the world. That's how she saved the place, because she figured out the computer thing. And, you know, there's a moment where the kid drops a little hint that, you know, gets the main characters rolling on a solution. But it's not like, you know, he just is like, oh my gosh. And then he says it, and then they, oh, hey, that's a good idea. He didn't mean it. So it doesn't come across as something totally contrived, is what the original, a lot of stuff did. So
do they have velociraptors in this one? They were kind of the premier dinosaurs.
Yeah, they did. And
are they considered the creepiest, or do we see some species of dinosaur?
There's some new stuff, I guess. And I don't know their names, unfortunately, because they're Latin. Give me a break. And I, you know, dinosaurs changed since I was a kid to when I was an adult. They're all, they all have different names. Same dinosaur,
Bigibus Maximus Reximus.
Right, stuff like that. But even more Latin than that. I mean, it's crazy. So I don't know the names, but there are some new dinosaurs that they show, like that fish one, the big huge fish one, and a couple, and the main antagonist is a new dinosaur. He's not a Tyrannosaurus Rex. He's kind of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. So, and they make him sufficiently threatening. And another aspect of the movie that was good is they immediately established that something's going to go wrong. Like when you walk into Jurassic Park, you know something's going to go wrong, but it's, you know, you knew that ahead of time. It wasn't from the movie that you knew something was going to go wrong. It was that you knew something was going to go wrong because it's a movie. Now, obviously, there's that aspect to this film, but they do establish immediately something is going wrong. We're doing something wrong and it's going to go bad for us. And while there's, as they sort of work their way into the wonder of the dinosaurs, they also work their way into the conflict, the plot, the danger. So you've got them both parallel. So again, that whole being overwhelmed by neato dinosaurs isn't part of this movie. There are really neat looking dinosaurs, but there's also the danger threatening at the same time. So that, again, works toward the story and towards the development of how it's going and the action and everything. So that's to the movie's advantage, which, you know, the original Jurassic Park didn't have.
Now, in the first movie, their way of keeping the dinosaurs under control, or so they thought, was to breed them all female.
Yeah.
And then they used frog DNA and that backfired. Now, how are they thinking they're going to control them now when obviously they learned from the first movie that they can't
right,
do
now
that?
That actually is not raised. Now, they talk about them being genetically engineered this time instead of brought out of the old stock of stuff found in amber, I guess.
So it's not from the mosquito bites of dinosaurs and being DNA in the blood?
I don't know, because they have a shot of this mosquito and amber in the lab in one scene. So right. I think it's both. I'm not sure. So... but basically, the answer to your question is they don't answer that question. They just, okay, there's dinosaurs and we're in control. And they, you know, make it clear that they've got a lot more safeguards in place. And it's an open park. And it's like SeaWorld, you know? You don't get eaten by Shamu in SeaWorld, do you? Unless you're a trainer, I guess. But
well, at SeaWorld, they're always saying your life is about to change. I guess at Jurassic Park, your life would really change.
Yes, there you go. Right, exactly. But, yeah, so I think what also is really good about this movie is that the thematic aspect of Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, is very rich. And I think that the director took the time to capitalize on that. There's more than meets the eye with Jurassic Park. It's not just about dinosaurs. Jurassic World. I keep calling it the wrong name. I apologize.
Do they explore the theme that Michael Crichton brought out in the book in more detail?
Get to that in a minute. Let's talk about some of the ones I saw, and then we can get to that. Because that is a really good question, and I think that's one of the most important questions to ask about Jurassic World.
It's so important. We're going to have to deal with it after the break. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others sadly do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
When the truth is found to be. You want somebody to love.
back to our program. I'm here with Mark Boobian, and he's in the middle of reviewing Jurassic World.
Jurassic World. Thanks for reminding me, Bob, because I'm going to keep saying it wrong. So I even have it in my notes as Jurassic Park. That's what's going wrong. You keep seeing that. Okay, so themes from Jurassic World, they're very rich, and I like that about the movie because it's, you know, we call these movies popcorn movies and we go to see them and we think we're just, you know, being entertained and it's mindless entertainment, but it's seldom is it mindless. If you just look a little bit below the surface in most movies, it's not mindless unless you want it to be. In this case, there's a lot to see. There's a strong environmental aspect to the movie, but not necessarily in the way we might expect. Okay, so here we've recreated the dinosaurs. Humanity has done this great scientific thing, recreated the dinosaurs. And throughout the film, their concern is actually not to destroy what they've created. And they make it clear at one point that, you know, there's a lot of sympathy for these animals when they're being destroyed. Even though we created them, and if you think about it, they don't even belong. They're from 20, 30, 40 million years ago. They're not a part of our ecosystem anymore. It's actually not necessarily even a good idea to have them here because they could cause so much damage rather than be a beneficial part to the ecosystem. So if we were really going to think it through environmentally, it would be destroy these things before they
One of the best lines from the book was, do you think there might have been a reason these things became extinct?
Right. There you go. And I mean, but in a little more modern sense, because they don't fit into our ecosystem, that's one reason that it's interesting to me that, okay, we created these, we're going to take care of them now. So from a purely logical, purely, maybe even if we were to call it evolutionary, atheistic evolutionary standpoint, that this is against evolution to bring something back that's been extinct because it's extinct for a reason. And again, it doesn't fit now because it's from so long ago. But there's this drive to care for them. There's this huge sympathetic element for the dinosaurs, the good dinosaurs. And where does that come from? That's the question I want to ask. Why do we feel sympathy for them? It's not just because they're cute. There's something
cute
about them. Well,
dinosaurs are cute.
Well, that, you know.
Maybe Dino of the Flintstones. That's about the only cute one I ever saw.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I didn't think Dino was cute. But I don't. The Brontosaurus, whatever they call them now, are cute. But they're big cute. But, I mean, they have a scene where it's obvious that they're, you know, cute kind of dinosaurs, even though they're gigantic.
Barney wasn't in this movie.
No, he wasn't. Okay. I don't think so, anyway. Maybe they dug him up somewhere.
Freaky dinosaur.
So this kind of reminds me of when God created man, one of the very first things he says to us, it's almost like the motivation for creating man. It's not, but it's stated that way in Genesis. God says, let us make man in our image and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and a bunch of other stuff. And now, this is just, you know, Genesis is kind of terse and brief, but it's there, and it's there twice, actually. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and govern it and rule over the animals. Now, God's not telling us, hey, take advantage of these things. They're yours. You can exploit them. That's not obviously where God would be going at this point. It's take care of them. I'm giving them to you as a gift, and it's your duty to be benevolent rulers, be compassionate rulers. And I think that that's something we've really got written in our souls from the very beginning. That's an aspect of all humanity. We care about the world, the environment, so to speak, even though that's a charged term these days politically, we all do care about the environment, be it your pet dog, your pet cat, the deer in the forest, the elephants in Africa, whatever it may be, there's something in us that makes us have compassion and a desire to take care of animals. And it's our sinful side that poaching comes from, that exploitation comes from. A great example for me is I've gone to Hawaii since I was 4 years old. I've been to the islands probably about 20 times throughout my life, especially as a surfer. The first time I went to Hawaii, I mean, I don't remember. I was four. Okay. So, but I never saw a turtle. And all the way to through my teen years, we went a couple of times, never saw a sea turtle. Never. I never asked why we didn't. They were always in movies and stuff, always in books. Never saw one. It wasn't until, I think, the late 90s that I saw my first sea turtle. And I was out surfing by myself in a spot, and a head popped up. Scared me to death, but it was a turtle. And ever since then, I've seen more and more and more turtles. Now, the reason for this is that in the 60s, turtle was a huge delicacy, and the hotels were serving it like crazy. So they wiped out the turtle population, but they recognized that they did that and then stopped doing it. It became illegal. And obviously, there's going to be poachers and stuff, but humanity as a whole said, hey, this is something worthwhile that we should preserve. And we did, and we were successful. It took a long time because turtles are like people. They have long lives, and they develop slowly. So that's why I never saw a turtle for all that time.
Well, refusing to eat turtles as a delicacy, that's the kind of environmentalism I could get enthusiastically behind.
Right, there you go. It's almost like Brussels sprouts.
To me, that would be something very easy to do.
Right. Well, we've never tried it. Now, I don't ever want to eat a turtle because I love turtles. They are cute. Anyway, so now we're talking about dinosaurs here. This is no relation to reality, but still there is something in the movie that taps into, I think, that aspect of us that we want to care for these creatures. Even the threatening ones have some kind of beauty to them that we sort of, I don't know, instinctually, for lack of a better term, acknowledge. And I think that again, that's a good question. Why are we instinctually connected to these things that aren't real? And why would we support the main characters helping the dinosaurs when, by all accounts, they should be destroyed, really? I mean, logically, evolutionarily, whatever. So that's one of the themes that I saw in the movie that's sort of there, but I don't know if it's intended, but it just comes out a little bit through the film. Now, another thing that we get in the movie that's a little more obvious, and you tend to see it in a lot of movies, is the idea of that greed and power are really driving everything. And so even though in Jurassic World there's this huge monster dinosaur, or two or three or four or five, and, you know, every other kind of terrible, scary dinosaur you could think of, they're not the villains. There's a dinosaur that's the threat. That's the thing that's trying to kill everybody, but it's not the bad guy. And it's clear that it's not the bad guy. It's just an animal that's doing what it was made to do. And it turns out it was made to kill because that's how it was designed. That was the thing. They genetically engineered it to be a killing machine, unbeknownst to the owner of the park. So there's this little military conspiracy going on behind the scenes.
Oh, you mean they were going to use them in a war?
Yes, exactly. Oh, so you've got the bad guys with greed and, you know, power behind them. That's their motivation, and they're the real villains.
Okay, more dinosaurs, more ethics when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bob Siegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
All right, Mark, we're down to our last segment. Mark is here with us, Mark Boobian, film critic. Jurassic World is the movie.
All right, well, so the thematic aspect of greed and power, that's an obvious thing that you'll see in, you know, a lot of Spielberg movies, probably a lot of movies in general. And it's played off well in this movie because actually, it's actually pretty obvious, an obvious thing to me. If you're going to make a dinosaur, hey, why don't make it a weapon? I mean, come on. Who's going to fight a dinosaur and win? Nobody. So it's to me, it's a little bit comical because it's just so obvious that they'd make it into a weapon.
Yeah, the now, canine patrol of the military would never quite be the same again.
No, they wouldn't, because they'd be 200 feet tall and just stepping on everything and then eating it after they stepped on it, I guess. But so to me, it was like, oh, this is such an obvious thing. That's so cool. But then, you know what? It's also the stupidest thing on earth you could ever do, because we don't control the dinosaurs. And that raises yet another theme that you can see in the movie. Hubris, the Greek idea that, you know, you've gone too far for your own good. It's all going to come back and get you. You know, you're too arrogant for your own. You're thinking beyond. It's like you're a god and you're really not. You're just a person. So this really becomes a story of man's arrogance. And throughout the movie, you know, the whole idea that they've rebuilt this park, it's like they assume, hey, we're above this. You know, we can control the dinosaurs. We made them. We built the park. There's people here. They're fun. We're great. There's nothing to worry about. So there's this huge amount of arrogance that isn't actually spoken of in the movie, but it's there because they made dinosaurs and they're going to make them into weapons, and we're watching them like they're toys. So it's just an interesting undercurrent throughout the film. And this connects a little bit more closely with the book than I think the other movies did. The other movies still had that bit of undercurrent, but they weren't, I didn't feel they were quite as pronounced, because the idea of the park being open really makes it clear that we don't fear something that we should. We don't have respect for something we should respect. We respect ourselves way too much. And so that's one of the big themes of the book, connected specifically to science. Now, the author of Jurassic Park, so now I'm getting the name right,
Michael Crichton,
a biologist actually at the Salk Institute here in San Diego. That's what he did before he became a writer. He wrote, I think it was The Andromeda Strain, in while he was working at the Salk Institute.
And he directed Westworld, so he has a thing about
world
amusement parks.
Yeah, gone bad.
Going bad.
Yeah, there you go. And this was right. This one is much more like Westworld than the others. He's a scientist. He's got a PhD, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, he's obviously a scientist. He's a doctor, a medical doctor. He was working in a research institute, the one that, Salk cured polio. So Michael Crichton was part of that, I'm pretty sure, part of stuff that went on after that. So we're talking about a scientist. Now, he has an insider view of the sciences. And built into Jurassic Park, the book, is this idea that not only are we arrogant, but we're arrogant about science in particular. Science without any morals, without any ethics, without any question. We don't say, should we pursue this idea? We say, let's pursue this idea. Let's go that way. Let's research this. Let's develop that.
He was asking the question, should we do something just because we can do something?
Right.
And that's the question the Bible puts out in the Tower of Babel.
There you go. Story. Right. I was actually going to bring that up too, and you beat me to it. Awesome. So yes, exactly. And it says in the Bible, in the Tower of Babel story, I think that you can do anything.
Nothing. Yeah. And I think he means collectively. Because obviously,
right,
no one human being could do everything. But with our, and that shouldn't surprise us. We're made in the image of God.
Right.
And God could do anything. I mean, anything that's intrinsically possible to do. And yet, so the problem was not in the ability, but that ability with the sin nature, that
right,
ability without the wisdom to temper the ability.
Exactly. And science, and we have never really said in science, why are we doing this? We developed the nuclear bomb. Now, I know a lot of people point back to the nuclear bomb and say, why did we do that? You guys are bad. But that's a lot of finger pointing. There's no pointing back at yourself. Should we have developed the nuclear bomb? That's a big, huge ethical question that we really can't ask now because we already did it. But let's point to the future, point to ourselves. Is there something bigger that we can develop that we maybe shouldn't? And Jurassic Park is about that. The book was about that. And what I loved about the book and what just tore me apart about the first Jurassic Park movie was that the book said, not only have we made dinosaurs, but we've made our own doom. Our own science has destroyed us. The dinosaurs get free in the book, and it is clear at the end of the book that they are taking over the world and humanity is absolutely doomed. And I was totally shocked and horrified at the end of the book. And I hated the book. I didn't like it at all, but that
ending scene. You don't mean that it wasn't well written. You just didn't like the feeling.
It wasn't well written. Sorry. Too much chaos theory.
Okay. So you didn't like the book, but you just related to that theme.
Yeah. At the end, it sold me a long way at the end because, yeah, that was such a powerful thing to hit you with in the very last page of the book. And I love that. Even if I didn't like the journey to get there, it still was a good ending. And Spielberg has the chance to popularize. I mean, he's popularizing this dinosaur stuff with this big, huge movie that everybody's going to see. And it's got a super important theme to modern times. And he abandoned the theme completely. And I was so disappointed because the idea that scientists should ask, why are we doing it? Even in the smallest thing, there's nothing wrong with asking why.
Well, particularly today, as we're getting into cloning and right. artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
I believe you told me yourself one time that there's very little discussion about the ethics of artificial intelligence.
Absolutely none.
Just because computers is Mark's field, but everybody.
Right.
But just we don't even understand what makes us sentient, which gives us consciousness. But if we have created these machines that somehow mimicked consciousness and developed it, what would we do with them?
Yes, and what would our responsibility be?
Would they be our slaves because they're our machines? I mean, could we be talking about another type of slave? There's all kinds of questions that are never being asked about.
Exactly. Well, the interesting thing is they are being asked, and this is from the very beginning of the robot
story. By science
story.
Fiction writers.
Exactly.
But not the scientists that are building them aren't asking them. Isaac Asimov and people like that are asking the question.
Yeah, and the irony is every really good story about robots, with the one exception of Asimov's story, is that robots are destroying us. I mean, they're androids are destroying us, but RUR is the first. It's actually called RUR. It's a story. It's a play. It's where we get the term robot, and it means slave or worker. But that story is basically Terminator from the very beginning to the end. It's they take over and they destroy their creators. And that idea is rife throughout science fiction with robots, but yet we're pursuing AI without stopping when all of the art we would go to see is warning us about it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, to me, that's funny and ironic, but it's also part of our culture that it's science. It's not, you know, it's.
Well,
it's
another irony is it clashes into a previous philosophy of Spielberg. When he made E.T. and Close Encounters, he was saying, we're always assuming that if aliens came to our world, they'd be evil and want to take over the world. Now, I agree that we should challenge that assumption because who knows what kind of aliens.
Right.
They could be benevolent. But his case about why they would be benevolent was what I thought was the lame case. That who could develop the technology to come from across the galaxy and then just feel like clubbing somebody over the head? In other words,
right.
related to intellect and technology is ethics. And yet the Nazis had incredible intellect. They did all kinds of
right.
scientific advances and experiments. They were ahead of us on the nuclear bomb. So this idea that just because we have an advanced technology, that means we're advanced ethically, it seems like this movie would be a real contradiction to the theme of previous Spielberg movies.
Right, exactly. And that's yet another good thing about the movie and a good reason to go see it. And it's a fun movie with good dinosaurs. So go
see
it.
All right. Well, you've sold me, Mark. I'm going to go out and see it. I saw the first one. I saw the second two lame ones. I'm up for a good one again.
Well, this is it.
All right. We'll see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.